You're not human.
That's hurtful. Are you that guy with the evil powers? I think everyone has dark urges. It's kind of my thing.
Welcome, adventurers, to this episode of the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. I'm D. Allen.
And I'm Donnie B. How are we feeling today?
Feeling good. It's episode 9. If you're new here, we are going through the He Who Fights with Monsters book series. Last week, we were talking about the economics of the Greenstone and surrounding regions. And just kind of talking about economics as a whole. What are we doing this week, Donnie?
Well, this week we're going to be talking about more of the story arc here. We're going to get back into it. We're going to go through chapters 24, 25, and 26 a little bit, where we actually get to the village, which I believe is Northwest Quarry Village number 4. It doesn't actually state it here in these chapters, but I think I'm remembering correctly. We talked a lot about
town name. So,
it is, isn't it?
Just brings to mind, you know, such nostalgic, reminiscent memories.
Does it?
Yeah. Old Quarry Town number 4.
Anyway, last time we talked a lot about the economics and the greater social norms of Palamustas and this region in particular. And, you know, as we all know, sociology and economics tend to go hand in hand. We've covered the economics. Yeah. So this time we're going to get a little bit more into the sociology and, you know, more specifically with the people that the team meets here and Jason interacts with. And it's going to be a good time.
Absolutely it is. And since we're talking about people, I want to just pick up today with Rufus. So in chapter 24, which we covered a lot of in the economics episode, but at the start of that chapter, they talk about how Rufus has just saved a number of Heidels from the manor that they just raided, the Blood Cult Manor, essentially knowing that if they walked away, those Heidels have no one to take care of them. They are going to die. Even though it's an oasis in the desert, if there's no one to give them the food, they're going to die of starvation in a few weeks at the very least.
Yeah, and that's absolutely killer to me, because when I read this, you know, you see Rufus being the hardcore, you know, grindstone adventurer that he needs to be. He has no problem killing the bad people. But at the same time, he's like, well, I'm not going to let defenseless animals that haven't done anything wrong just die because it's inconvenient for us. And he absolutely takes on that humanitarian effort, and he's gonna bring them with him. They have the ability to save them. He's going to save them. And I think at the moment they have 8 Heidels in total. He's riding one, they've got one pulling the carriage that they're on, and then he's towing another half dozen behind him.
Right. And I believe what Anissa, or how did they even end up with the Heidels in the first place?
Well, they were going, Jason passed out, and they're like, well, we're going to head out anyway. And so they were looking for a way of kind of leaving the estate. They found the shed with a carriage in it, and then they found the stables that had all the Heidels in them, and they needed a Heidel to pull the carriage. So they're like, yep, let's do one of those. And then That's when Rufus is like, well, we can't leave the rest of them, which Anissa is against. She's like, that's a waste. Stop doing that. This is my mission. Right. I want to be on it. And Rufus is like, no. No, it's not your mission. Yeah. We're doing it.
Right. Like, yeah, he could have just taken what they needed, but was like, hey, like, I'm going to be compassionate and save these other creatures regardless of whether it's a waste or not, because saving a life is never a waste.
Exactly.
Beautiful. And so, I guess that brings us to Jason waking up and dealing with Anissa And we kind of see a few different sides of how Jason can interact with people in this series of chapters. So,
oh yeah.
So right here with Anissa, you know, because she's in a position where at least she feels like she has power over him because she's a more competent essence user. He's just some scrub that she kind of finds impure. So she's kind of holding herself at this elevated level of power. And if you're a returning reader of the series, you already know if there's someone in a place of power trying to put that in Jason's face, he's going to laugh and talk shit about them to their face.
Oh, absolutely. And Jason is 100% a subscriber of the respect is earned, not given mindset. And this is the first example that we really see of it. And we will continue to see examples of this throughout the entire series. You know, to Anissa, she is the pinnacle of all society. She is, you know, the priestess of purity. She knows everything. She knows how you should live. She knows how you should be. And anything less than that is just dirt under her boot. And, you know, Jason reacts to this with, well, if you're not going to give me the respect that I'm owed, I'm not going to give you the respect you think you deserve. And it's the same thing with the team. He meets Rufus, and Rufus is automatically respectful of him. And he returns that respect immediately. He has no hard feelings with anybody else. But if somebody's going to talk down to him, he's going to come right back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we also see, like, way earlier in the book, when they're first interacting, Jason makes a comment like, "Yeah, you want to stay away from the ones that are talk about purity all the time. They tend to go a little off the rails." And that really does describe, like, his interactions with pretty much anybody in purity. He is just like, "Yeah, y'all are like essentially Nazis to me."
Oh, 100%. And I do think that kind of viewpoint is a little bit skewed with, you know, the way Earth's history has been. And I'm sure, especially long before this current church outfit with, you know, the false god and everything is, there was a time when purity was just like the church of healing. It was the church of pure souls and removing curses and unholy afflictions and your disease from the world. I'm sure they were a good outfitting to have. And I'm sure there are still priests and churches like that in other parts of the world. You know, this is a prime example of how when you redefine what purity means, it can lead to death. I would say death is a good word.
That's fair. And honestly, I think it's an interesting allegory to how most religions end up, you know, in our actual world, where, you know, they may have been started with the best of intentions, you know, by people who genuinely got it, genuinely cared, and were like, "Hey, this is how I think we should be doing this, because, you know, this is how I interpret it." And then, you know, like a game of telephone, either the, you know, like the interpretation will get changed throughout the years, or some undue influence will change the direction or meaning of that idea in the first place. And then, you know, you end up with Southern Baptists.
No, there's absolutely in every religion that we have currently, there is some, at least one branch or offshoot of that religion that is extremely radicalized and like, no, this is what it means. Everybody else has to die. Not necessarily die, but, you know, it's like the heathens of the world must suffer because they don't agree with how we believe in this. And I think it's just an interesting metaphor that we see here. In this case, it's the entire church throughout the series that gets brought down. But you know, I think every religion has that section in their history.
Yeah, that is true. And I mean, throughout our own history, you can see, you know, the rise of, you know, the far radical right all over the place, and it always ends badly and bloodily. And it almost always involves someone talking about purity of some sort. Like,
yeah,
methinks the concept of us all being one is probably the reason Jesus got nailed to a tree, but you know, I get it. It's a scary idea. That's so funny.
Yes, Anissa, bad.
Right, that's what we were talking about. you get me started on religion, and I'm gonna run with it. You gotta watch out. But what we do see after these interactions with Anissa, we get a lot much. What the fuck?
We do, man? Get a lot much.
Fuck.
How much? A lot.
It's a lot much.
It is a lot much.
Jeez. It's a lot much. Or is much.
It a much lot?
Don't even start. I'm going to forget what I was talking about. Oh, no. What was I talking about? You know, because Anissa does not approach Jason with any form of respect. And pretty much anybody in power, and this is in real life or not, just people in power tend to treat people less than them as exactly that, less than them. I mean, you and I both work in customer service, and you know how those types of people are.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I've been thinking on this too. The biggest issue that Jason faces, like, in this society, in this series, you know, he is coming from a 21st century version of society and going into what is essentially a 16th, 17th century version of society. And, you know, to these people in this culture, having power means having power. You know, and to them, respect means obedience. And, you know, just the ideas that have evolved through the human race over the centuries, it's if I'm in a position of power over you, I'm more important than you are. You serve me. That's just how it is. And a lot of the people that he has issues with authority, don't have that form of thinking that he grew up with in his society, in his time and age, where everybody is equal. And I think that's the point of essences in general. You know, people with essences have a physical manifestation of authority and power.
Right.
And, you know, in, to this society, that means something, but it doesn't to Jason because politics.
Okay. And so we didn't really touch on this in the economics episode, but I do think it's relevant in this scenario because I don't think that their society functions as a capitalistic society. There is, you know, money and trading, of course, but I think, if I'm reading the room correctly, or reading the series correctly, I think that Palamustis as a whole would function more as a socialistic society as opposed to a capitalistic society.
I would say yes and no. If I had to classify it, I would say it's definitely capitalist, but it's more based on the bartering of resources than anything, because the money they use, the spirit coin, are just a magical resource. So it's not so much money as it is resources just in a currency form. But you definitely have, you know, the rich get what they want because they have the money. If you don't have the money, you don't get what you want. It's just easier to accrue resources.
Okay, so I think I was not specific enough in my terminology. I think what I more was getting at, and I constantly make this faux pas, but it's that Palimustis doesn't have a consumeristic society.
Elaborate.
So, I mean, capitalism is always going to be present in some form, or at least to our current understanding of how the world works. But in Palimustis, like you just said, it's a barter of resources because money isn't necessarily a resource. It's just magic, and magic's everywhere. But the point that I'm getting at is that you don't see people in Palimustis obsessed with, oh, well, I need the very specific brand of Awakening Stone. You don't see Nike Awakening Stones or anything. I'm sure you have sellers that do specific things, but their society doesn't revolve around buying those things like ours does. Because their society is much more about keeping society safe from monsters. Like, that's the core focus of their society. And so everyone's a lot more willing to work together in this trading bartering system. And that's kind of why I said it was, you know, it's somewhere in between a communistic and socialistic society. I would say closer to socialism, just because, you know, whoever has more power has more power. But
that would be communism.
Well, fair enough.
Socialism is everybody is equal and everybody has the same resources. I think you're confusing consumerism with capitalism.
That's what I was saying.
Even in Greenstone, you've got every tailor has their own brand and their own way of doing things. We get to Vitesse, you have multiple different vehicle outletters, and certain families are known for doing better at that. So it's not like a company of Nike is just a family that makes this. It's still a branding thing, but nobody really shares anything. Everything is for sale.
Yes, and that's what I was trying to explain as my faux pas was I was confusing capitalism with consumerism, because like I said, capitalism exists in Palimustis. You know, everybody's trying to sell their goods. The point I'm getting at though is, you know, you don't see the Burt's running ad campaigns saying buy Burt's stuff. You know, like they're just, you know, they're doing business, but it's not a consumeristic, you have to buy Burt's because Burt's is the best. It's just like, man, you already know, like if you got the money, you can buy for me. If not, goodbye. But it's not like it's not even really regarded as a status symbol in their society. It's just, you know, if you can afford nicer things, you have nicer things. But here you have the lower class constantly pining for those nicer things. And we don't really see that, at least not really represented in this series, I don't think. They don't pine over objects and stuff. They pine over power, you know, so like I said, you know, somewhere in between a socialistic and communistic society.
I would still say they're hardcore capitalists.
Well, yeah, I've already retracted that statement. I retracted the capitalist statement. I'm saying consumerism. They don't engage in consumerism. They engage in capitalism, not consumerism.
I think we are very off track.
Yes, but that's okay, because we're talking about the sociology of Palimustis, so that's okay.
That's okay.
We're on track. We're talking about the society and the socioeconomic place and things.
I think we should revisit this when we do get to Greenstone and then later on into Vitesse to see the different styles of people who have money and how they spend it.
Agree. And I mean, it's something we can follow, but you know, we can keep track of whether or not they're a consumeristic society or not. Because yes, They're a capitalistic society. They are not a consumeristic society.
Not 100%.
But moving on from nitpicking about what kind of society they are, because we can do this all day, and we would,
all day.
But we're not going to do that. Because I have a different question for you entirely.
Shoot it.
What animal in Palamustis do you think eggs come from?
I think there's a variety of egg-laying animals.
I know what tangent you're about to go on. That's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is, if you're baking a cake in Palamustis and you grab that recipe book, it's going to say, add egg. You go to the grocery store or the market, whatever, you're going to have some animal in Palamustis that is the primary egg giver. Sure, we can eat ostrich eggs and robin eggs and other eggs that we want to. There's plenty of eggs in the real world, but we eat chicken eggs. If you see egg in a book, they're not saying, oh, go grab an ostrich egg. You know innately it's a chicken egg. So what animal do you think in Palamustis is the primary egg giver?
I don't have an answer for you with the restrictions you've placed on me.
What?
I think
how
the
are
primary,
those restrictions?
I think the primary egg-giving creature of any given region would depend on the region in which you are. Right? Because like in our world, we have the industrial ability to have chickens literally anywhere you want to have chickens. I don't think they have that ability in Palamustis, to the point where like every single egg that you buy at any given market is more than likely going to come from creature A. I think it's going to be, hey, we've got a lot of lizards out here. These are lizard eggs. Or if you go to Vitesse, hey, we've got a lot of winged creature eggs. These are winged creature eggs. I think it's very dependent on where you are and what creatures are available to you.
Okay, I disagree, though. Because I have two words for you. Portal specialist. Say everybody likes this one lizard's eggs. Man, would love those eggs. Boom. Two lizards through a portal. They breed.
I have two words for you. Full consent. If an animal doesn't consent to going through a portal, you can't make it go through that portal.
When do we see that?
That is the restriction on every portal ability ever. It's reiterated several times.
No, they say if a person... I've never heard about...
It's soul-level consent. You have to consent to it. If a creature looks at a portal is scared of that portal, you cannot force it through that portal.
Okay, but how
do
we...
Even if you're unconscious, you can't knock somebody unconscious and carry them through a portal because they didn't consent to go through that portal.
Well, but how do we know that the animals in question have souls? Where do we see that? We know monsters certainly don't.
We've had this debate, I believe, in episode 2 with the Umbro Mountain Snake.
Elaborate.
Bonded familiars do not dissolve into rainbow smoke because they're creatures, real creatures with real souls.
Well, monsters did it specify dissolve souls?
Yeah, that's the point.
What? No, I think
it has a real
yes.
soul, so it doesn't break down. The only reason monsters break down into rainbow smoke and go berserk after a time is because they don't have a real soul. The soul is what keeps the body alive.
Okay, but I feel like Jason has absolutely transported animals through his portals.
Not that I can recall.
What about like
not
the Bright Heart
familiars.
City? What about like the Bright Heart City, like livestock and other stuff? Like you think that only the people made it through? Like
I think only the animals that weren't scared to go through it made it through.
Well, they weren't. No one went through it, did they? Did they? I thought he just kind of absorbed the city.
That's a whole different thing.
Still a portal.
We'll talk about soul realms later.
Okay.
I think we're also missing a key factor. Even if they could transport large masses of animals across the world using portals,
you wouldn't need large masses. Male, female, boop, reproduce. Now they're on this continent. That's literally how it works in the real world.
Yeah, but that only works to a degree. You can produce X amount with this breeding stock, and it takes a while to do that. It would be so much easier if you're going to use portals to just take, you know, 50 of these things through the portal.
Sure, and if that's...
And have 25 sets of breeding stock.
Cool, and if that's the capability, boom, that's even better. Like, you know...
That's all you gotta also, do. You have to consider they have to build the infrastructure to house and keep these animals, right? You have to be able to import the food that they require. You have to be able to match the climate that they need in some kind of habitat. You put a chicken in Antarctica and feed it fish, it's going to die. That's how it works.
That's semantics.
No, that's logistics.
No, but the point of it is, it's semantics though, because yes, logistics would happen if we were transporting species to where they, you know, don't come from. However, if everybody agrees that these are the best eggs, then I don't think anyone's going to have any problems setting up the infrastructure if it means they can have the best eggs. Just like it happened in real life on our planet. Everyone was like, hey, yo, chicken eggs? That's the egg right there. They're easy to maintain, easy to produce. So I guarantee there'd probably be some animal on Palamustis that this happened to. And this is not, I mean, it may be a reflection of like 16th century society, but they have fridges, they have stoves. It's not entirely a reflection of that society. So I do think this society is a lot more advanced. And in the growth of this society over the thousands of years, just like it happened on our world, without portal specialists, literally with just people walking around the planet, we transported chickens all over the planet, by land, by sea, whatever it may be. Now, everywhere in the world, chicken eggs are the common egg. Not to say it's the only egg, but it is the common egg of the realm.
This is all assuming that they have a chicken analog in Palamustis. Chickens are the egg because they produce eggs frequently. They eat anything. They can live anywhere. You have to have an animal that meets those requirements. This is a pre-industrial society. So if you have an animal that can live anywhere, that can eat anything, then sure, that would work, possibly. But if you don't have that exact kind of creature, then you're limited to what you have around you. If the eggs they use here come from an animal that can't live anywhere else, that's not the common egg.
I have multiple problems with your statement.
Go for it. I see it. Think about it. Chickens are the best because they just walk around. They eat whatever's on the ground. They poop breakfast every day. And they're easy to maintain.
Okay. First off, we know that there are lizard species like that in Palamustis. I would wager probably that is the species in question. But did you really just say this is a pre-industrial society? Bro, they've got like water link, teleportation. Like, this is not pre-industrial society.
They do not have globalization and the mass movement of resources that you would see in an industrial age society like we have on Earth. Hence, everything in this village is made of stone or thatch, not wood that they can just ship in from anywhere in the world.
Okay, hold on. We have mass movement of resources, and yet there are plenty of countries in Africa who live in thatch houses. No. And we see, like, bro, we see diamond rankers moving and selling mass amounts of stuff all the time, all over the place. One diamond ranker is its own shipping lane. Like,
right, but diamond rankers wouldn't involve themselves in the movement of resources from Quarry Village number 4 to Greenstone or to
Batas. Right. They trickle down economics.
They operate on a level above economics in general.
Right.
They don't use money.
Well, but they do.
At least they trade in barters.
Well, but the thing is they trade. It's still a manner of trickle down economics. You know, diamond ranker barters this giant ship to regular guy because regular guy has some legendary diamond rank thing that the guy wants. Boom. Well, now that guy goes and sells, and, you know, top down, trickle down economics. You know, that one thing that diamond ranker did just funded like a billion other things.
Yeah, I don't think diamond rankers deal with normal people ever.
Okay, that's fine. Gold rankers can still accomplish quite a lot.
Yeah, look at Amir. He deals with diamond rankers all the time. He doesn't deal with normal people often.
Amir deals with normal people.
Not often.
No, he's a treasure hunter. He deals with normal people all the time to get treasure. What are you talking about?
Anyway.
Amir's actually a great example on my point because he moves very expensive stuff all over the place. And because everything is based around magic, which is the coin of the realm, he is essentially a heavy resource mover. So
he doesn't deal in anything common people would use.
Right. That's where the trickle down part comes in. Because, yeah, Quarry Village number 4 is not going to be visited by people like Amir. They're going to have to deal with whatever they can get and barter with out of Greenstone. And Greenstone's only going to get what they can barter with any gold ranker that happens to pass by or whatever. But still, and this is another point on the communism side of things, but it's still trickle down economics, whether you look at it one way or the other.
I'm going to say Heidel.
Okay.
I think Heidels are the main egg layers of the
realm. Heidels are the main egg layers. Wow.
Everything we use is Heidel eggs.
Okay, but how big are those eggs then? It's a big egg. It's like eating ostrich eggs every day. Well, I guess one egg would feed an entire family, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it would.
I feel like Jason would have mentioned that, though. If it was specifically Heidel's, Jason would have been like, but it's Heidel eggs.
He absolutely mentions eggs in here.
Yes, but he doesn't say Heidel eggs. He says he doesn't know what creature they came from. And yes, we're going to get right back to him cooking breakfast for everybody. That's why I'm talking about eggs in the first place.
I know, but that was 20 minutes ago. Hold on a sec.
That's what they call entertainment.
Hold on a sec. I'll give us the best description of the eggs that we get from the book, and then we'll decide.
Going to be in chapter 25.
The son-in-law eggs. We need to make son-in-law eggs. Write that down. Legitimately write that down. No idea why they're called that, by the way, or what kind of animal these eggs are from. Delicious, though. The dish was eggs that had been boiled deep-fried, served in halves with a sauce, fried onions, garnish. They're delicious eggs. I would assume they're relatively normal sized eggs that we would see on Earth.
Right.
Possibly a little bit bigger. I don't know. I think they're different everywhere.
I don't know. I think that there's got to be one animal. However, this does bring us to the whole reason I'm even talking about eggs, which is Jason being a fantastic cook, which essentially brings us to like that other version of how he treats people, because the minute he gets into a realm or the minute he gets into a kitchen, he is in his realm. No longer is he on another world. He's like, oh man, what ingredients do I got? What can I do with them? And it becomes his reaching out point to talk to just the local people. He goes to the street market where food is being sold and he's striking up conversations with food sellers.
Yeah. Well, and this is, I think this is one of those moments. So maybe get to this village. He starts wandering off on his own. That's like the moment he decides, I'm going to be something I never could be back home. I'm going to do something with my life I never did before. We know he has a very strong passion for cooking. And I think this is where we really see him start to take in and be like, you know what? I'm going to follow this passion. I'm going to do something with it. And I'm going to reinvent myself with this. So his goal is to learn about cooking in this world and be the same version that he could have been back home, but here. And we see that take over a lot. I think this is his manifestation of a new Jason that we're finally starting to see come out.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a new Jason because, you know, later in the series, we get descriptions that he was on cooking shows and stuff. Like, I think this is more his grounding, you know? This is like the only place in Palamustis where he can feel at home, you know? But it extends beyond just cooking. It also extends to people. He's always been a people person.
I think so, yeah. I hadn't thought of it like that, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's not... Like he's always been a chef. Cooking has always been his thing. So the minute he's doing anything involving food, like this is the first time he's really doing something with food in Palamustis ever. But the minute he's in a food environment, all of a sudden he's in his element and he's like, oh, what's in that sauce? You got to tell me, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, oh, comfort zone. Like this is Jason finally like, oh, I can be comfortable and relax.
Yeah. His escape from the horrors of his new world.
Exactly. This is his grounding and first time being comfortable in Palamustis of any sort.
That's amazing. Yeah. He throws himself into this because it's something familiar, something he knows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's an experience that he can share with the people around him, like the son-in-law eggs. I'd be willing to bet nobody on Palamustis has made son-in-law eggs and be like, hey, let me show you something. And everybody's like into it. It's somewhere he can feel confident and safe.
Right. And through that, it becomes a bridge towards these people. And we see that literally after just one night of being in town, he intimately knows these people. He talks about them like they're old friends. You know, like, oh, Martha and George and Greg and, you know, whatever. Like, it's so much so that even Farah is like, is the world you were brought from this village? Like,
yeah. Yeah, he says, you got to talk to old Murph down at the general store. He knows all the town secrets.
Right.
And it's like, he learned this all in one night. He's just been going around talking to people, you know. And this is a very small town vibe area. You know, everybody's proud of their village and their community that they've built, and they're willing to share that with whoever is interested in it. And he really takes to that. He is very much, yeah, tell me everything about your place. You know, I want to learn about you as a people, and they're willing to oblige. And I think that really takes Farah specifically here off guard, you know, because the idea of going somewhere and actually meeting the people and talking to the people and becoming them, it's kind of foreign to big city adventurers like this.
Right, because their life is always on the move. So the only people they genuinely interact with are other adventurers or other people in high society that they have to deal with in their duties as an adventurer. So to them, stopping to chat with the locals is, you know, effectively pointless because, like, you know, when am I ever going to be back here? What do you even matter? But Jason understands that at every level, people are people. Yeah. And this is yet again another like moment where Sherdaloon is kind of poking you like, hey, pay attention. People are people everywhere, no matter what level of society you're talking to them at. People are people, and how you approach them is what matters. And I think these are really good contrasting images where, you know, Anissa approaches him disrespectfully, rude, turning her nose up at him. I mean, literally, he even says, I'm amazed she doesn't bump into things, always looking down her nose like that. Like, yeah. Sick burn, by the way. But like, he talks about her in a very rude and disrespectful way, but only because that's the energy she came at him with.
Yeah.
And, you know, meeting Dan on the street, making the skewered meat and sauce, you know, he's talking to him fondly and wonderfully, like, you know, like they're old friends just sharing their cooking secrets. And yeah. It's literally all about the respect that he was given, you know, upon meeting.
Yeah. And that's what it is too. I just think Jason's ability to match energy is really what the series is about in terms of, you know, like political science and culture differences. And, you know, treating people like people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reiterated a lot in here, but this is a prime example, really first time we see it without all the noise of, you know, the rest of the story arc and what's happening in the series.
Yeah.
Just sit here and focus on everybody is a person and everybody deserves that respect.
100%. And that, you know, and that's, I think, what we see all the way up when he's, you know, dealing with astral beings is, you know, the respect given is the respect shown. And it really humanizes everybody at every rank level. And I think, you know, I think Jason as a character is a mirror to society, you know, both Palamustis and us, the reader. Like it's showing you, like, hey, look at how these interactions go. You know, it's all allegory for real world interactions.
Oh, yeah. I think Jason put it best when he said, gods are people too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exactly the sentiment I'm talking about is, you know, at every level, people are people. Gods are people too. Like, you know, and I like that idea, even just on a philosophical idea that, you know, if there is really something out there, intelligent creator, well, with intelligence comes thoughts and comes feelings. So if there is indeed an intelligent creator out there, they definitely are a person to some capacity, maybe on a scale that we wouldn't understand, but still, if you were able to get to that scale, you'd be like, ah, he's just a dude doing his thing.
Yeah. And speaking of gods, I think it's very important. This is a good time to bring it up. We talk about the very first instance of Jason's catchphrase. Anissa accuses him of blasphemy. And he says, blasphemy is kind of my thing.
Right. And then I think Gary right after is like, I thought cooking was your thing. And he's like, I can have more than one thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that will be, we're going to keep track. I have a whole list set up. We're going to keep track of all of Jason's things throughout the series. But right here, we have his first two things, blasphemy and cooking.
Absolutely.
Apparently go hand in hand.
And for any keen listeners, you'll actually note that this instance of kind of my thing is actually what we pulled for our intro.
Yes, it is. This exact moment right here.
This exact moment in the audiobook. Yeah.
Kind of my thing.
It's kind of my thing. Which is fantastic. Yeah. And I mean, that is a very true statement. Blasphemy is absolutely his thing.
Yes.
But so the context, though, of this situation is it's once again Anissa being rude, being pushy, judgy. And, she kind of gets in his face and he's like, yeah, blasphemy, kind of my thing. And Rufus sends her away, like basically like, yeah, take a walk, get out of here. Like, and the minute she goes away, he's like, dude, you need to chill. Like, can you? And he's like, I don't think I can. And this prompts Rufus to kind of give him the talk about like his old life versus his new life.
Yeah, it's like, you haven't been able to in the past. I understand that this is a gut reaction for you immediately, but you're trying to be this better person, be this better person, and the full teacher monologue comes out right here.
100%.
And yeah, and this is really where he buckles down and admits. He's like, yes, I am going to be a better version, be what he never could be back on Earth. And he
Yeah.
actually resolves right here. He says, I'm gonna be better than I ever was. And when I return to Earth, if I ever return to Earth, I'm gonna be better for it, which we see later that he doesn't, in fact, because of the whole everything that we've talked about in previous episodes, about trying to deal with who he was while introducing who he is now.
Right.
But I mean, that's a whole thing we'll get into about whether he is better, what he isn't better about, stuff like that when we get there. But
Yeah,
this is that
100%.
moment where he's like, I am going to be better, and then when I go back, I'm going to make it better.
Yeah, and once again, great allegory for life, and that'd be really cool when we do that episode because I've got a lot of stuff to talk about that.
That's going to be its whole episode.
Right. But because it's relevant to this chapter, just the one thing I want to mention is the quote that he actually says is, I can be the person I choose to be without all the baggage of my old life, is like the direct quote of what he says. And, like this really is a rare blank slate opportunity for him. And he does embrace the blank slate and launch himself into this new life. And one element about it is how he interacts with society in general. One thing I notice about him and like how he deals with money is it's really not a thing for him. In fact, he has limitless amounts of money effectively for the town he's in. I mean, one gold coin could buy a building. And showing another good element of his character, he could literally buy this entire town with the money he has on him.
Yeah.
And he could absolutely act like, oh, well, I've got the money now. But money has never been his concern, and he doesn't treat it like that. He treats it like a tool, not a weapon. And so that's what allows him to talk to the common man and the rich man, because money to him is pointless. It's nothing. It's a tool, a very useful tool, sure, but it's a tool and nothing more to Jason.
Right.
And so, while we see him out on the market, just interacting with everybody and meeting and talking and befriending everybody, he has the power monetarily to flaunt around and be like, oh, well, I want the nicest things. I want the blah, 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 blah. But he doesn't do that. He's just like, hey, how you guys doing? You having a good night? I'm Jason.
He's still rediscovering this whole world and talking to people through that. And
Yeah.
speaking of this, there was just the interactions in general. There was something I kind of wanted to talk about. a little bit of crossover between the like the real world and the video game analogy happening. Because when I'm reading through this the first time, you know, as he's talking to different people, getting different information, different little pieces of advice, you know, it initially it has the feel of, you know, walking into your first village on a video game, like an RPG video game,
where right,
you talk to everybody and everybody's got a little hint for the character. Everybody's got some lore for the character. You know, you talk to everybody, you find out all the information type thing. But you know, being in, you know, small towns, you know, while I've been traveling around and stuff in real world and knowing people from small towns in the real world, this is just kind of how it is. You know, if you talk to people, they are more than willing to give you the information about their little town, you know, they're right, more than willing to talk about it, you know, in that same way. So it's like, while it has a little bit of that same video game type feel that the beginning of this series has, it is a it's just kind of an interesting crossover I've noticed into the real world, where it's not like a video game trope. That's really how small towns are, you know.
Yeah. Oh, dude, cool. That's so funny, because yeah, you go to any small town and you know you will get the same kind of lore, like yeah, Murph over at the gas station, he'll tell you just about anything you need to know about just about anybody in this town. He keeps his eye on the town. You know, you go to Murph, like you could probably real life side quest if you just go to a small town. Like you find out that, you know, Bob's truck is broken down and he wants to buy the part, but, you know, Bill won't sell it to him because of a 10-year-old grudge. You could literally go in and like, well, either solve or cause problems in a small town in real life if you wanted.
That's true. Dude, this last weekend, I was actually driving through Missouri. And I was kind of taking the back roads to get to a gas station. Long story. Anyway, I passed through this one town. I can't remember what the name of the town was. But it, the sign, as you were entering town, said population 122. You know, and my first thought was, hell, I know 122 people. I just know 122 people.
That's fair.
And it's like, living in this town, I actually thought of these chapters because I was rehearsing for my notes and everything for this episode. I was like, you know, I bet this town is a lot like the Quarry Village. I bet it is. You go up and talk to somebody, you ask them a question, they're going to give you the information and the lore. And they're going to know everybody in town and who does what and who's good at what.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That would be, if I had an extra day, I would absolutely spend a day in this town just doing that. You know, trying to find out everything from everybody.
And to put that into perspective, I was just at a concert the other day. And there were at least 6,000 people there. And it's like, man, like that entire town wouldn't even fill up like one section of the arena that we were at.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's insane. That's like, yeah. And this definitely gives off those vibes. However, it was funny because you were mentioning like it's like a video game trope or just a story trope in general. And like the two examples that came to mind when you mentioned that were first off just Whiterun from Skyrim. Like that town is like the epitome of like the intro town. Because you go in and like you can get side quests that'll send you this way or that way. You can get pointed in the way of factions and other fun just intro stuff that you can like, oh, hey, here's different ways you can go, different things you can do. And then the other example I thought of is another audiobook series, actually, is the Bobaverse series. I will probably talk about this all the time because it's a fantastic series and you and I both know it well. But yeah. When they first get into Heaven's River, and they're at Garrick's Spine, like the description of Garrick's Spine is like essentially the same vibe as Quarry Village number 4. Like, it's just this rustic pre-industrial kind of vibe, and we get just, you know, it's intro town, we're trying to talk to the locals, we're trying to do all this, like it's almost the same vibe, like sneaking into Heaven's River or visiting Quarry Village number 4. It's like the same idea, at least story trope wise.
Oh, 100% it is. And one of my favorite things about this series in particular is this is not like just an intro level trope that we see, you know, this is not just for the beginning, like it is with most video games. And we only see it a couple of times in the Babaverse series, but like with this one, he does this in every village that they go to. You know, like every time he visits a town in the Delta, or he goes to a fortress town around Vitesse, or really anywhere in general, you know, he'll always stop. He'll know almost everybody in town. He'll get to know almost everybody in town. You know, when they go on a little bit later, and I think the next book, when they go on as a team, a training exercise, their punishment run, you know, clearing the villages, he stops at every village, and they, you know, get to know everybody. They stop for a healing session for everybody in town. Even during the Adventure Society exam, you know, the entire exam, they're stopping at a village so that he can stop and heal everybody for the day. Right. You know, he can talk to everybody, and it repeats anytime he is anywhere interacting with normal people. You know, we see this repeat. He gets to know everybody, he gets to know everything about the town, and that's just the kind of person that he is. You know, for this book, it's not a trope, it's part of his personality.
Yeah, that's so good. A fact I just noticed when you were talking was Sherdaloon is really good with like the Chekhov's gun thing, because here in this book, and actually almost, I think, pretty close to where we're at in these chapters, Rufus or someone explains punishment detail being like, you know, going town to town and like solving problems. And like I said, Sherdaloon is just really good with that Chekhov's gun thing of like, okay, he said that, okay, this is a punishment, this is what people do on punishment runs. Next book, hey, now the group's going on a punishment run, so you can know what those are like. Like, he really, like, he'll put something in as an idea, and then he'll flesh that idea out later, and I love that. Like, I just caught that. I was like, oh, wait, I forgot that he does a punishment run because of some political nonsense that didn't actually deserve punishing. Like, he saved the day, but we're going to punish you anyway. But we get to explore what a punishment run might look like, and we get to see Jason's spin on that. But yeah, it's just cool that, you know, again, always Sherdaloon with setting things up and really fleshing his world out. Like, I think that's why I love this series so much, is he just really knows what he wants to write about and really like explores the ideas in what he's talking about.
Oh, yeah. Well, going through the series as much as I have, you know, I'm always looking for plot holes or inconsistencies or something that I can find, you know, specifically with this podcast, you know, doing, you know, theory episodes that we plan on doing, trying to find those areas where it's like, well, this happened, but they said here, and I can't, you know, I can't find anything like that. Because he knows his world. He built this world specifically to, you know, run around and play in with Jason. And he is so good, you know, even things that are mentioned now that we don't see till book 11, book 12, you know, it comes back as a continuation instead of an introduction to a new idea. And it is so beautiful the way that this whole world is written.
Right. And on the topic of descriptions, in chapter 26, we get like a lot of descriptive language about the waterfall. And Sherdaloon, I think, just really pays attention to how the world works. So we get treated to a lot of really cool, interesting little descriptions of what's going on with this waterfall. So they talk about, you know, the great height and like the railing, and it like puts in my mind that like unease just by reading the description, like that unease of like looking over and seeing the water going, and as it's going, as they go higher up on it, it's the cacophony of sound. And then they get to this section where it actually dries them off. And based on the description, it is like all natural physics based with maybe a little bit of rune magic, but I think it might actually just be physics based, where the air gets like sucked in from like the wind going by and then blown onto you through small little holes. The only thing I couldn't quite parse is if there was magic behind it aiding it, or if it's just a physics thing.
No, it is absolutely a perfect example of Magitech. Because you know, you have the waterfall on one side and the desert on the other side of this mountain. And so they use magic to suck the air from one side of the mountain, the dry desert air, and then it goes through an array that, you know, speeds up the drying of it. It takes all of the humidity out of the air, right? Mm. And then it goes through and it blows onto them to dry them off. So there is a bit of magic involved, but they're using the natural air that's present in the area already, and they're just taking it from there. It's basically a fan. They just incorporate a fan into it with a little bit of magic to help it dry more.
Right. Now, what I wonder, though, is how much of it really is Magitech and how much of it is, like, just physics, though. Because, like, there absolutely are examples in, like, our own history of, like, weird devices that, you know, function on just wind or water, all throughout history, that, you know, just utilize the geography or whatever it may be to accomplish a result. You know what I mean?
I do, but they have magic, so they wouldn't need something like that. They can just make it happen magically.
Hmm. But I mean,
that goes into the whole way that people think in this society. You know, if you can do it with magic, why would you think of a different way to do it? There's a lot of things that they do in this world that wouldn't ever occur to them. There's a lot of things that we do in our world that wouldn't even occur to them because they have magic.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and we've touched a little bit on, like, you know, even just the idea of like the internet or cell phones, like mass communication. Like, they have the means for mass communication, but because magic is accomplishing their needs well enough, and there isn't really societal pressure to make it happen, which touches back on my consumerism thing. You know, you don't see people clambering to, I have to be able to go here, talk this, buy this, whatever, in these places, since there is, like, there isn't that kind of economic pressure. They don't really need mass communication, at least on a global scale, because realistically, what purpose does someone in Greenstone serve someone in Vitesse, unless there's some bigger schemey thing that everybody's in on? But it's like, you know, like, economically speaking, those two are very separate from each other. Which I think is a point against me in the egg argument.
I think it is.
Damn it.
But also, I mean, you see Neil Devone's family, the entire Devone family is rich and famous because of the tea that they grow. They export that all over the world. People are going to Greenstone and buying from Greenstone to get Devone tea.
Fair.
So,
yes, I think capitalism.
Consumerism exists for the elite class.
I guess that makes sense. Damn, I wish it only worked for the elite class here as well.
Oh, but we can afford it.
Yeah, but it's all nonsense, made by the same low-quality production means.
True. But we don't have the need to struggle to survive at the moment. First world problems.
And Palamustis does have quite a need to struggle to survive because they are constantly getting monster surges.
Yes, they are. There is one thing that I wanted to bring up about the astral space in general. It's just a quick little note that I had that I felt I wanted to discuss.
Right.
So when we, going back earlier, when we're coming into the town, we first see the waterfall. You know, Farrah is explaining astral spaces to Jason, which is where we first get our look at astral spaces. And this is just something I wanted to mention because this is like the only time that we see Farrah assume Jason doesn't know something, right? The entire book up to here, Farrah's like, oh, I keep forgetting you don't know anything. And this time she's like, oh, you don't know what an astral space is. And then Jason comes in and just guesses based on deduction.
Right.
He's like, oh, yeah, it's this, right? Because that's what those two words mean. So that's what it must be. And Farrah's like,
Yeah,
it is.
He's like, yeah, it's a pocket dimension is what he calls it.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's like, yeah, I guess.
It's like, this is just one of those moments. I'm like, well, of course she keeps forgetting you don't know anything because you say shit like that.
Sure.
And you know something that she would assume you wouldn't know. So then, yeah, now next time she's just going to assume you know it when you don't. It's just like a weird thing connected with the waterfall that I picked out.
Oh, that's funny.
Nothing to do with what we're talking about, but.
Right. And I guess to explain the waterfall a little bit, though, how it's, you know, the water is literally coming out of an astral space and being projected into this dimension from wherever it's coming from. We don't actually get to see inside of this astral space. Well, we see into it like a little bit. We see into it, but we don't actually like go into it. But we just see like a foresty scene with water coming out of it. And I wondered though, because this is another dimension, is there like an airlock of sorts between the astral space and like the regular dimension? Did Palamustis people, did Quarry Village number 4 people install, you know, an airlock of sorts to hopefully protect them
from,
well, anything coming through the other side?
No, I don't think so, because they can freely pass between the two, and the water's coming out from it.
Right, but wouldn't you think that an airlock of sorts, like a magical airlock, like not like an airlock literally, but the concept of a, you know, protective barrier in between, even just a magical barrier of sorts, like I would think that that would be common tech over here. Like you have a portal that you don't want things to go in or out of. Why would you not have defenses stopping things from coming in and out? You know what I mean?
I mean, I can see that for sure. I don't think it ever occurred to them. I mean, nobody's ever tried to go in or come out of there to do malicious things. I mean, none of the other apertures are protected from this astral space. And I mean, the builder cult gets in there pretty easy and starts messing around. So I don't think they just ever really thought it. It's just like a freak of nature for them, you know, like a cave opening. I don't think they've ever thought, hey, maybe some pretty bad stuff's going to come out of here. We should protect it.
I mean, it's Palamustis, though. You would think, right? You would think that this would be like common thought. Like,
with how rare astral space apertures are, I don't really think there's a dedicated need for it.
Right. But okay. If an astral space just popped open in, you know, in the middle of downtown, what is the first thing that American society is going to do?
Okay. Two issues with that. First, they don't really just pop open. Most of the time, their people go out, search for them, and open them themselves.
Okay.
Second, these aren't Americans. We can't think like that.
Okay, but Earthlings then, because Earthlings respond in a way, regardless. What would we do there?
We'd probably look at it and then put up a barricade?
Yeah, we'd put some form of barrier between the random dimension hole and us, because, you know, the gate anime is a good example.
I mean, yeah. But also, you could look at solo leveling as another example.
Sure, I guess.
I think in the minds of the Palamustians, if I may, the astral space apertures are in remote enough locations that they're not really causing an issue for anybody. You know, in this case, there's one just on the top of a random mountain out in the middle of nowhere, and mm-hmm. it's giving them magical water. So, yeah, throw a guard up there, make sure nobody messes with it. You know, the other astral apertures that we see in the world, I imagine, go something like, hey, I'm going to open this door, and since I'm the one that opened it, I don't got to worry about it. You know, we have the control over this because we opened it. It's ours. Oh, you know, we'll send somebody through point. To clear out whatever's on the other side, but then we don't got to worry about it because we control it. You know, and in this case, nothing's ever come out of this particular one except magical water. And from what we can assume, nothing ever has caused any danger from the other ones. So why would they think about that?
Well, I would agree with all of that, except for one vital point.
Elaborate?
Yeah, something's coming through that hole.
This is true.
And what that something is, you'll have to tune in next week to find out, because we are out of time for this episode.
Yes, we are. Ooh, this is going to be a fun one next time. Something's not coming out of that hole that should be. Something is coming out of that hole that shouldn't be. And now Jason and our hero Hiram are going to have to deal with it.
Yes, they are. And it's going to be essentially the first real monster battle that Jason has. So I look forward to talking about it.
I do too. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to deep dive. We'll get to see some of his new abilities in action. And we'll get to see how he kind of handles himself in what is more or less a solo fight. So I'm here for it. I'm ready.
Heck yeah. So thank you guys for listening today. This has been the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. I've been D. Allen.
And I've been Donnie B. Make sure you check us out on Team Biscuit on YouTube or HSXWM on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes. And just to let you know, that's H3WM, which we are copywriting as HSXWM.
Remember, fight monsters.
But don't become one. Have a good night, everybody.